counters up front, laden with thick catalogs and tattered binders, people would haggle for switches, resistors, capacitors, and sometimes the latest memory chips. His father used to do that for auto parts, and he succeeded because he knew the value of each better than the clerks. Jobs followed suit. He developed a knowledge of electronic parts that was honed by his love of negotiating and turning a profit. He would go to electronic flea markets, such as the San Jose swap meet, haggle for a used circuit board that contained some valuable chips or components, and then sell those to his manager at Haltech. Jobs was able to get his first car, with his father's help, when he was 15. It was a two-tone Nash Metropolitan that his father had fitted out with an MG engine. Jobs didn't really like it, but he did not want to tell his father that or miss out on the chance to have his own car. In retrospect, a Nash Metropolitan might seem like the most wickedly cool car, he later said. But at the time, it was the most uncool car in the world. Still, it was a car, so that was great. Within a year, he had saved up enough from his various jobs that he could trade up to a red Fiat 850 coupe with an Abarth engine. My dad helped me buy and inspect it. The satisfaction of getting paid and saving up for something, that was very exciting. That same summer, between his sophomore and junior years at Homestead, Jobs began smoking marijuana. I got stoned for the first time that summer. I was 15 and then began using pot regularly. At one point, his father found some dope in his son's Fiat. "What's this?" he asked. Jobs coolly replied, "That's marijuana." It was one of the few times in his life that he faced his father's anger. "That was the only real fight I ever got in with my dad," he said. But his father again bent to his will. He wanted me to promise that I'd never use pot again, but I wouldn't promise. In fact, by his senior year, he was also dabbling in LSD and hash, as well as exploring the mind-bending effects of sleep deprivation. I was starting to get stoned a bit more. We would also drop acid occasionally, usually in fields or in cars. He also flowered intellectually during his last 2 years in high school and found himself at the intersection, as he had begun to see it, of those who were geekily immersed in electronics and those who were into literature and creative endeavors. "I started to listen to music a whole lot, and I started to read more outside of just science and technology. Shakespeare, Plato. I loved King Lear." His other favorites included Moby Dick and the poems of Dylan Thomas. I asked him why he related to King Lear and Captain Ahab, two of the most willful and driven characters in literature, but he didn't respond to the connection I was making, so I let it drop. "When I was a senior, I had this phenomenal AP English class. The teacher was this guy who looked like Ernest Hemingway. He took a bunch of us snowshoeing in Yosemite." One course that Jobs took would become part of Silicon Valley lore, the electronics class taught by John McCollum, a former Navy pilot who had a showman's flair for exciting his students with such tricks as firing up a Tesla coil. His little stockroom, to which he would lend the key to pet students, was crammed with transistors and other components he had scored. McCollum's classroom was in a shed-like building on the edge of the campus next to the parking lot. "This is where it was," Jobs recalled as he peered in the window. "And here, next door, is where the auto shop class used to be." The juxtaposition highlighted the shift from the interests of his father's generation. Mr. McCollum felt that electronics class was the new auto shop. McCollum believed in military discipline and respect for authority. Jobs didn't. His aversion to authority was something he no longer tried to hide, and he affected an attitude that combined wiry and weird intensity with aloof rebelliousness. McCollum later said, "He was usually off in a corner doing something on his own and really didn't want to have much of anything to do with either me or the rest of the class. He never trusted Jobs with a key to the stockroom. One day, Jobs needed a part that was not available, so he made a collect call to the manufacturer, Burroughs, in Detroit, and said he was designing a new product and wanted to test out the part. It arrived by air freight a few days later. When McCollum asked how he had gotten it, Jobs described, with defiant pride, the collect call and the tale he had told. "I was furious," McCollum said. "That was not the way I wanted my students to behave." Jobs' response was, "I don't have the money for the phone call. They've got plenty of money." Jobs took McCollum's class for only 1 year, rather than the 3 that it was offered. For one of his projects, he made a device with a photocell that would switch on a circuit when exposed to light, something any high school science student could have done. He was far more interested in playing with lasers, something he learned from his father. With a few friends, he created light shows for parties by bouncing lasers off mirrors on the speakers of his stereo system. The launch, October 1988. Jobs had perfected the art of turning product launches into theatrical productions, and for the world premiere of the next computer on October 12, 1988, in San Francisco's Symphony Hall, he wanted to outdo himself. He needed to blow away the doubters. In the weeks leading up to the event, he drove up to San Francisco almost every day to hole up in the Victorian house of Susan Kerr, Next graphic designer, who had done the original fonts and icons for the Macintosh. She helped prepare each of the slides as Jobs fretted over everything from the wording to the right hue of green to serve as the background color. "I like that green," he said proudly as they were doing a trial run in front of some staffers. Great green," they all murmured in assent. No detail was too small. Jobs went over the invitation list and even the lunch menu: mineral water, croissants, cream cheese, bean sprouts. He picked out a video projection company and paid it $60,000 for help. And he hired the postmodernist theater producer George Coates to stage the show. Coates and Jobs decided, not surprisingly, on an austere and radically simple stage look. The unveiling of the black, perfect cube would occur on a starkly minimalist stage setting with a black background, a table covered by a black cloth, a black veil draped over the computer, and a simple vase of flowers. Because neither the hardware nor the operating system was actually ready, Jobs was urged to do a simulation, but he refused. Knowing it would be like walking a tightrope without a net, he decided to do the demonstration live. More than 3,000 people showed up at the event, lining up 2 hours before curtain time. They were not disappointed, at least by the show. Jobs was on stage for 3 hours, and he again proved to be, in the words of Andrew Pollock of the New York Times, the Andrew Lloyd Webber of product introductions, a master of stage flair and special effects. Wes Smith of the Chicago Tribune said the launch was to product demonstrations what Vatican II was to church meetings. Jobs had the audience cheering from his opening line, "It's great to be back." He began by recounting the history of personal computer architecture, and he promised that they would now witness an event that occurs only once or twice in a decade, a time when a new architecture is rolled out that is going to change the face of computing. The next software and hardware were designed, he said, after 3 years of consulting with universities across the country. What we realized was that higher ed wants a personal mainframe. As usual, there were superlatives. The product was incredible, he said, the best thing we could have imagined. He praised the beauty of even the parts unseen, balancing on his fingertips the foot square circuit board that would be nestled in the foot cube box. He enthused, "I hope you get a chance to look at this a little later. It's the most beautiful printed circuit board I've ever seen in my life. He then showed how the computer could play speeches. He featured King's I Have a Dream and Kennedy's Ask Not, and send email with audio attachments. He leaned into the microphone on the computer to record one of his own. "Hi, this is Steve, sending a message on a pretty historic day." Then he asked the audience to add a round of applause to the message, and they did. One of Jobs' management philosophies was that it is crucial every now and then to roll the dice and bet the company on some new idea or technology. At the next launch, he boasted of an example that, as it turned out, would not be a wise gamble. Having a high-capacity but slow optical read-write disk and no floppy disk as a backup. 2 years ago, we made a decision, he said. We saw some new technology, and we made a decision to risk our company. Then he turned to a feature that would prove more prescient. What we've done is made the first real digital books, he said, noting the inclusion of the Oxford edition of Shakespeare and other tomes. There has not been an advancement in the state of the art of printed book technology since Gutenberg. At times, he could be amusingly aware of his own foibles, and he used the electronic book demonstration to poke fun at himself. A word that's sometimes used to describe me is mercurial, he said, then paused. The audience laughed knowingly, especially those in the front rows, which were filled with Next employees and former members of the Macintosh team. Then he pulled up the word in the computer's dictionary and read the first definition: of or relating to or born under the planet Mercury. Scrolling down, he said, "I think the third one is the one they mean, characterized by unpredictable changeableness of mood." There was a bit more laughter. If we scroll down the thesaurus, though, we see that the antonym is Saturnine. Well, what's that? By simply double-clicking on it, we immediately look that up in the dictionary, and here it is. Cold and steady in moods, slow to act or change, of a gloomy or surly disposition. A little smile came across his face as he waited for the ripple of laughter. Well, he concluded, I don't think mercurial is so bad after all. After the applause, he used the quotations book to make a more subtle point about his reality distortion field. The quote he chose was from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. After Alice laments that no matter how hard she tries, she can't believe impossible things, the White Queen retorts, Why, sometimes I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. Especially from the front rows, there was a roar of knowing laughter. All of the good cheer served to sugarcoat or distract attention from the bad news. When it came time to announce the price of the new machine, Jobs did what he would often do in product demonstrations, reel off the features, describe them as being worth thousands and thousands of dollars, and get the audience to imagine how expensive it really should be. Then he announced what he hoped would seem like a low price. We're going to be charging higher education a single price of $6,500. From the faithful, there was scattered applause. But his panel of academic advisors had long pushed to keep the price between $2,000 and $3,000, and they thought that Jobs had promised to do so. Some of them were appalled. This was especially true once they discovered that the optional printer would cost another $2,000, and the slowness of the optical disc would make the purchase of a $2,500 external hard disk advisable. There was another disappointment that he tried to downplay. Early next year, we will have our 0.9 release, which is for software developers and aggressive end users. There was a bit of nervous laughter. What he was saying was that the real release of the machine and its software, known as the 1.0 release, would not actually be happening in early 1989. In fact, he didn't set a hard date. He merely suggested it would be sometime in the second quarter of that year. At the first Next retreat back in late 1985, he had refused to budge, despite Joanna Hoffman's pushback, from his commitment to have the machine finished in early 1987. Now it was clear it would be more than 2 years later. The event ended on a more upbeat note, literally. Jobs brought on stage a violinist from the San Francisco Symphony who played Bach's A minor violin concerto in a duet with the Next computer on stage. People erupted in jubilant applause. The price and the delayed release were forgotten in the frenzy. When one reporter asked him immediately afterward why the machine was going to be so late, Jobs replied, "It's not late. It's 5 years ahead of its time." As would become his standard practice, Jobs offered to provide exclusive interviews to anointed publications in return for their promising to put the story on the cover. This time he went one exclusive too far, though it didn't really hurt. He agreed to a request from Business Week's Katie Hafner for exclusive access to him before the launch, but he also made a similar deal with Newsweek and then with Fortune. What he didn't consider was that one of Fortune's top editors, Susan Fraker, was married to Newsweek's editor, Maynard Parker. At the Fortune Story Conference, when they were talking excitedly about their exclusive, Fraker mentioned that she happened to know that Newsweek had also been promised an exclusive, and it would be coming out a few days before Fortune's. So Jobs ended up that week on only two magazine covers. Newsweek used the cover line, "Mr. Chips," and showed him leaning on a beautiful Next, which it proclaimed to be the most exciting machine in years. Businessweek showed him looking angelic in a dark suit, fingertips pressed together like a preacher or professor. But Hafner pointedly reported on the manipulation that surrounded her exclusive. Next carefully parceled out interviews with its staff and suppliers, monitoring them with a censor's eye, she wrote. That strategy worked, but at a price. Such maneuvering, self-serving, and relentless, displayed the side of Steve Jobs that so hurt him at Apple. The trait that most stands out is Jobs' need to control events. When the hype died down, the reaction to the Next computer was muted, especially since it was not yet commercially available. Bill Joy, the brilliant and wry chief scientist at rival Sun Microsystems, called it the first yuppie workstation, which was not an unalloyed compliment. Bill Gates, as might be expected, continued to be publicly dismissive. "Frankly, I'm disappointed," he told the Wall Street Journal. "Back in 1981, we were truly excited by the Macintosh when Steve showed it to us, because when you put it side by side with another computer, it was unlike anything anybody had ever seen before. The Next machine was not like that. In the grand scope of things, most of these features are truly trivial." He said that Microsoft would continue its plans not to write software for the Next. Right after the announcement event, Gates wrote a parody email to his staff. "All reality has been completely suspended," it began. Looking back at it, Gates laughs that it may have been the best email I ever wrote. When the Next computer finally went on sale in mid-1989, the factory was primed to churn out 10,000 units a month. As it turned out, sales were about 400 a month. The beautiful factory robots, so nicely painted, remained mostly idle, and Next continued to hemorrhage cash. Chapter 19. Pixar. Technology meets art. Lucasfilm's computer division. When Jobs was losing his footing at Apple in the summer of 1985, he went for a walk with Alan Kay, who had been at Xerox PARC and was then an Apple fellow. Kay knew that Jobs was interested in the intersection of creativity and technology, so he suggested they go see a friend of his, Ed Catmull, who was running the computer division of George Lucas's film studio. They rented a limo and rode up to Marin County to the edge of Lucas's Skywalker Ranch, where Catmull and his little computer division were based. I was blown away, and I came back and tried to convince Scully to buy it for Apple, Jobs recalled. But the folks running Apple weren't interested, and they were busy kicking me out anyway. The Lucasfilm computer division made hardware and software for rendering digital images, and it also had a group of computer animators making shorts, which was led by a talented cartoon-loving executive named John Lasseter. Lucas, who had completed his first Star Wars trilogy, was embroiled in a contentious divorce, and he needed to sell off the division. He told Catmull to find a buyer as soon as possible. After a few potential purchasers balked in the fall of 1985, Catmull and his colleague Alvy Ray Smith decided to seek investors so that they could buy the division themselves. So they called Jobs, arranged another meeting, and drove down to his Woodside house. After railing for a while about the perfidies and idiocies of Scully, Jobs proposed that he buy their Lucasfilm division outright. Catmull and Smith demurred. They wanted an investor, not a new owner. But it soon became clear that there was a middle ground. Jobs could buy a majority of the division and serve as chairman, but allow Catmull and Smith to run it. I wanted to buy it because I was really into computer graphics, Jobs recalled. I realized they were way ahead of others in combining art and technology, which is what I've always been interested in. He offered to pay Lucas $5 million plus invest another $5 million to capitalize the division as a standalone company. That was far less than Lucas had been asking, but the timing was right. They decided to negotiate a deal. The chief financial officer at Lucasfilm found Jobs arrogant and prickly. So when it came time to hold a meeting of all the players, he told Catmull, "We have to establish the right pecking order." The plan was to gather everyone in a room with Jobs, and then the CFO would come in a few minutes late to establish that he was the person running the meeting. But a funny thing happened, Catmull recalled. Steve started the meeting on time without the CFO, and by the time the CFO walked in, Steve was already in control of the meeting. Jobs met only once with George Lucas, who warned him that the people in the division cared more about making animated movies than they did about making computers. "You know, these guys are hell-bent on animation," Lucas told him. Lucas later recalled, "I did warn him that was basically Ed and John's agenda. I think in his heart, he bought the company because that was his agenda, too." The final agreement was reached in January 1986. It provided that for his $10 million investment, Jobs would own 70% of the company, with the rest of the stock distributed to Ed Catmull, Alvy Ray Smith, and the 38 other founding employees down to the receptionist. The division's most important piece of hardware was called the Pixar Image Computer, and from it the new company took its name. For a while, Jobs let Catmull and Smith run Pixar without much interference. Every month or so, they would gather for a board meeting, usually at Next headquarters, where Jobs would focus on the finances and strategy. Nevertheless, by dint of his personality and controlling instincts, Jobs was soon playing a stronger role. He spewed out a stream of ideas, some reasonable, others wacky, about what Pixar's hardware and software could become. And on his occasional visits to the Pixar offices, he was an inspiring presence. "I grew up a Southern Baptist, and we had revival meetings with mesmerizing but corrupt preachers," recounted Alvy Ray Smith. "Steve's got it. The power of the tongue and the web of words that catches people up. We were aware of this when we had board meetings, so we developed signals, nose scratching or ear tugs, for when someone had been caught up in Steve's distortion field and he needed to be tugged back to reality." Jobs had always appreciated the virtue of integrating hardware and software, which is what Pixar did with its image computer and rendering software. It also produced creative content, such as animated films and graphics. All three elements benefited from Jobs' combination of artistic creativity and technological geekiness. Silicon Valley folks don't really respect Hollywood creative types, and the Hollywood folks think that tech folks are people you hire and never have to meet, Jobs later said. Pixar was one place where both cultures were respected. Initially, the revenue was supposed to come from the hardware side. The Pixar Image Computer sold for $125,000. The primary customers were animators and graphic designers, but the machine also soon found specialized markets in the medical industry. CAT scan data could be rendered in three-dimensional graphics, and intelligence fields for rendering information from reconnaissance flights and satellites. Because of the sales to the National Security Agency, Jobs had to get a security clearance, which must have been fun for the FBI agent assigned to vet him. At one point, a Pixar executive recalled, Jobs was called by the investigator to go over the drug use questions, which he answered unabashedly. The last time I used that, he would say, or on occasion he would answer that no, he had actually never tried that particular drug. Jobs pushed Pixar to build a lower-cost version of the computer that would sell for around $30,000. He insisted that Hartmut Esslinger design it, despite protests by Catmull and Smith about his fees. It ended up looking like the original Pixar Image Computer, which was a cube with a round dimple in the middle, but it had Esslinger's signature thin grooves. Jobs wanted to sell Pixar's computers to a mass market, so he had the Pixar folks open up sales offices in major cities, for which he approved the design, on the theory that creative people would soon come up with all sorts of ways to use the machine. My view is that people are creative animals and will figure out clever new ways to use tools that the inventor never imagined, he later said. I thought that would happen with the Pixar computer, just as it did with the Mac. But the machine never took hold with regular consumers. It cost too much, and there were not many software programs for it. On the software side, Pixar had a rendering program known as Reus. Renders everything you ever saw for making 3D graphics and images. After Jobs became chairman, the company created a new language and interface named RenderMan that it hoped would become a standard for 3D graphics rendering, just as Adobe's PostScript was for laser printing. As he had with the hardware, Jobs decided that they should try to find a mass market rather than just a specialized one for the software they made. He was never content to aim only at the corporate or high-end specialized markets. He would have these great visions of how RenderMan could be for every man, recalled Pam Kerwin, Pixar's marketing director. He kept coming up with ideas about how ordinary people would use it to make amazing 3D graphics and photorealistic images. The Pixar team would try to dissuade him by saying that RenderMan was not as easy to use as, say, Excel or Adobe Illustrator. Then Jobs would go to a whiteboard and show them how to make it simpler and more user-friendly. We would be nodding our heads and getting excited and say, "Yes, yes, this will be great," Kerwin recalled. And then he would leave, and we would consider it for a moment and then say, "What the heck was he thinking?" He was so weirdly charismatic that you almost had to get deprogrammed after you talked to him. As it turned out, average consumers were not craving expensive software that would let them render realistic images. RenderMan didn't take off. There was, however, one company that was eager to automate the rendering of animators' drawings into color images for film. When Roy Disney led a board revolution at the company that his uncle Walt had founded, the new CEO, Michael Eisner, asked what role he wanted. Disney said that he would like to revive the company's venerable but fading animation department. One of his first initiatives was to look at ways to computerize the process, and Pixar won the contract. It created a package of customized hardware and software known as CAPS, Computer Animation Production System. It was first used in 1988 for the final scene of The Little Mermaid, in which King Triton waves goodbye to Ariel. Disney bought dozens of Pixar image computers as CAPS became an integral part of its production. Animation. The digital animation business at Pixar, the group that made little animated films, was originally just a sideline, its main purpose being to show off the hardware and software of the company. It was run by John Lasseter, a man whose childlike face and demeanor masked an artistic perfectionism that rivaled that of Jobs. Born in Hollywood, Lasseter grew up loving Saturday morning cartoon shows. In ninth grade, he wrote a report on the history of Disney Studios, and he decided then how he wished to spend his life. When he graduated from high school, Lasseter enrolled in the animation program at the California Institute of the Arts, founded by Walt Disney. In his summers and spare time, he researched the Disney archives and worked as a guide on the Jungle Cruise ride at Disneyland. The latter experience taught him the value of timing and pacing in telling a story, an important but difficult concept to master when creating frame-by-frame animated footage. He won the Student Academy Award for the short he made in his junior year, Lady and the Lamp, which showed his debt to Disney Films and foreshadowed his signature talent for infusing inanimate objects such as lamps with human personalities. After graduation, he took the job for which he was destined as an animator at Disney Studios. Except it didn't work out. Some of us younger guys wanted to bring Star Wars-level quality to the art of animation, but we were held in check, Lasseter recalled. I got disillusioned. Then I got caught in a feud between two bosses, and the head animation guy fired me. So in 1984, Ed Catmull and Alvy Ray Smith were able to recruit him to work where Star Wars-level quality was being defined, Lucasfilm. It was not certain that George Lucas, already worried about the cost of his computer division, would really approve of hiring a full-time animator, so Lasseter was given the title Interface Designer. After Jobs came into the scene, he and Lasseter began to share their passion for graphic design. I was the only guy at Pixar who was an artist, so I bonded with Steve over his design sense, Lasseter said. He was a gregarious, playful, and huggable man who wore flowery Hawaiian shirts, kept his office cluttered with vintage toys, and loved cheeseburgers. Jobs was a prickly, whip-thin vegetarian who favored austere and uncluttered surroundings. But they were actually well-suited for each other. Lasseter was an artist, so Jobs treated him deferentially, and Lasseter viewed Jobs correctly as a patron who could appreciate artistry and knew how it could be interwoven with technology and commerce. Jobs and Catmull decided that in order to show off their hardware and software, Lasseter should produce another short animated film in 1986 for SIGGRAPH, the annual computer graphics conference. At the time, Lasseter was using the Luxo lamp on his desk as a model for graphic rendering, and he decided to turn Luxo into a lifelike character. A friend's young child inspired him to add Luxo Jr., and he showed a few test frames to another animator who urged him to make sure he told a story. Lasseter said he was making only a short, but the animator reminded him that a story can be told even in a few seconds. Lasseter took the lesson to heart. Luxo Jr. ended up being just over 2 minutes. It told the tale of a parent lamp and a child lamp pushing a ball back and forth until the ball bursts to the child's dismay. Jobs was so excited that he took time off from the pressures at Next to to fly down with Lassiter to SIGGRAPH, which was being held in Dallas that August. It was so hot and muggy that when we'd walk outside, the air hit us like a tennis racket, Lassiter recalled. There were 10,000 people at the trade show, and Jobs loved it. Artistic creativity energized him, especially when it was connected to technology. There was a long line to get into the auditorium where the films were being screened, so Jobs, not one to wait his turn, fast-talked their way in first. Luxo Jr. got a prolonged standing ovation and was named the best film. "Oh, wow," Jobs exclaimed at the end. "I really get this. I get what it's all about." As he later explained, "Our film was the only one that had art to it, not just good technology. Pixar was about making that combination, just as the Macintosh had been." Luxo Jr. was nominated for an Academy Award, and Jobs flew down to Los Angeles to be there for the ceremony. It didn't win, but Jobs became committed to making new animated shorts each year, even though there was not much of a business rationale for doing so. As times got tough at Pixar, he would sit through brutal budget-cutting meetings showing no mercy. Then Lasseter would ask that the money they had just saved be used for his next film, and Jobs would agree. Tin Toy. Not all of Jobs' relationships at Pixar were as good. His worst clash came with Catmull's co-founder, Alvy Ray Smith. From a Baptist background in rural North Texas, Smith became a free-spirited, hippie computer imaging engineer with a big build, big laugh, and big personality, and occasionally an ego to match. Alvy just glows with a high color, friendly laugh, and a whole bunch of groupies at conferences, said Pam Kerwin. A personality like Alvy's was likely to ruffle Steve. They are both visionaries and high energy and high ego. Alvy is not as willing to make peace and overlook things as Ed was. Smith saw Jobs as someone whose charisma and ego led him to abuse power. "He was like a televangelist," Smith said. "He wanted to control people, but I would not be a slave to him, which is why we clashed. Ed was much more able to go with the flow." Jobs would sometimes assert his dominance at a meeting by saying something outrageous or untrue. Smith took great joy in calling him on it, and he would do so with a large laugh and a smirk. This did not endear him to Jobs. One day at a board meeting, Jobs started berating Smith and other top Pixar executives for the delay in getting the circuit boards completed for the new version of the Pixar Image Computer. At the time, Next was also very late in completing its own computer boards, and Smith pointed that out. "Hey, you're even later with your Next boards, so quit jumping on us." Jobs went ballistic, or in Smith's phrase, totally non-linear. When Smith was feeling attacked or confrontational, he tended to lapse into his southwestern accent. Jobs started parodying it in his sarcastic style. "It was a bully tactic, and I exploded with everything I had," Smith recalled. "Before I knew it, we were in each other's faces, about 3 inches apart, screaming at each other." Jobs was very possessive about control of the whiteboard during a meeting, so the burly Smith pushed past him and started writing on it. "You can't do that," Jobs shouted. "What?" responded Smith. "I can't write on your whiteboard?" "Bullshit." At that point, Jobs stormed out. Smith eventually resigned to form a new company to make software for digital drawing and image editing. Jobs refused him permission to use some code he had created while at Pixar, which further inflamed their enmity. "Alvy eventually got what he needed," said Catmull, "but he was very stressed for a year and developed a lung infection. In the end, it worked out well enough. Microsoft eventually bought Smith's company, giving him the distinction of being a founder of one company that was sold to Jobs and another that was sold to Gates." Ornery in the best of times, Jobs became particularly so when it became clear that all three Pixar endeavors, hardware, software, and animated content, were losing money. "I'd get these plans, and in the end I kept having to put in more money," he recalled. He would rail, but then write the check. Having been ousted at Apple and flailing at Next, he couldn't afford a third strike. To stem the losses, he ordered a round of deep layoffs, which he executed with his typical empathy deficiency. As Pam Kerwin put it, he had neither the emotional nor financial runway to be decent to people he was letting go. Jobs insisted that the firings be done immediately, with no severance pay. Kerwin took Jobs on a walk around the parking lot and begged that the employees be given at least 2 weeks' notice. "Okay," he shot back, "but the notice is retroactive from 2 weeks ago." Katmull was in Moscow, and Kerwin put in frantic calls to him. When he returned, he was able to institute a meager severance plan and calm things down just a bit. At one point, the Pixar animation team was trying to convince Intel to let them make some of its commercials, and Jobs became impatient. During a meeting in the midst of berating an Intel marketing director, he picked up the phone and called CEO Andy Grove directly. Grove, still playing mentor, tried to teach Jobs a lesson. He supported his Intel manager. "I stuck by my employee," he recalled. "Steve doesn't like to be treated like a supplier." Grove also played mentor when Jobs proposed that Pixar give Intel suggestions on how to improve the capacity of its processors to render 3D graphics. When the engineers at Intel accepted the offer, Jobs sent an email back saying Pixar would need to be paid for its advice. Intel's chief engineer replied, "We have not entered into any financial arrangement in exchange for good ideas for our microprocessors in the past, and have no intention for the future." Jobs forwarded the answer to Grove, saying that he found the engineer's response to be extremely arrogant, given Intel's dismal showing in understanding computer graphics. Grove sent Jobs a blistering reply, saying that sharing ideas is what friendly companies and friends do for each other. Grove added that he had often freely shared ideas with Jobs in the past, and that Jobs should not be so mercenary. Jobs relented. "I have many faults, but one of them is not ingratitude," he responded. "Therefore, I have changed my position 180 degrees. We will freely help. Thanks for the clearer perspective." Pixar was able to create some powerful software products aimed at average consumers, or at least those average consumers who shared Jobs' passion for designing things. He still hoped that the ability to make super realistic 3D images at home would become part of the desktop publishing craze. Pixar's Showplace, for example, allowed users to change the shadings on the 3D objects they created so that they could display them from various angles with appropriate shadows. Jobs thought it was incredibly compelling, but most consumers were content to live without it. It was a case where his passions misled him. The software had so many amazing features that it lacked the simplicity Jobs usually demanded. Pixar couldn't compete with Adobe, which was making software that was less sophisticated, but far less complicated and expensive. Even as Pixar's hardware and software product lines foundered, Jobs kept protecting the animation group. It had become for him a little island of magical artistry that gave him deep emotional pleasure, and he was willing to nurture it and bet on it. In the spring of 1988, cash was running so short that he convened a meeting to decree deep spending cuts across the board. When it was over, Lasseter and his animation group were almost too afraid to ask Jobs about authorizing some extra money for another short. Finally, they broached the topic, and Jobs sat silent, looking skeptical. It would require close to $300,000 more out of his pocket. After a few minutes, he asked if there were any storyboards. Catmull took him down to the animation offices, and once Lasseter started his show, displaying his boards, doing the voices, showing his passion for his product, Jobs started to warm up. The story was about Lasseter's love, classic toys. It was told from the perspective of a toy one-man band named Tinny, who meets a baby that charms and terrorizes him. Escaping under the couch, Tinny finds other frightened toys, but when the baby hits his head and cries, Tinny goes back out to cheer him up. Jobs said he would provide the money. "I believed in what John was doing," he later said. "It was art. He cared, and I cared. I always said yes." His only comment at the end of Lasseter's presentation was, "All I ask of you, John, is to make it great." Tin Toy went on to win the 1988 Academy Award for Animated Short Films, the first computer-generated film to do so. To celebrate, Jobs took Lasseter and his team to Green's, a vegetarian restaurant in San Francisco. Lasseter grabbed the Oscar, which was in the center of the table, held it aloft, and toasted Jobs by saying, "All you asked is that we make a great movie." The new team at Disney, Michael Eisner, the CEO, and Jeffrey Katzenberg in the film division, began a quest to get Lasseter to come back. They liked Tin Toy, and they thought that something more could be done with animated stories of toys that come alive and have human emotions. But Lasseter, grateful for Jobs' faith in him, felt that Pixar was the only place where he could create a new world of computer-generated animation. He told Catmull, "I can go to Disney and be a director, or I can stay here and make history." So Disney began talking about making a production deal with Pixar. Lasseter's shorts were really breathtaking, both in storytelling and in the use of technology, recalled Katzenberg. "I tried so hard to get him to Disney, but he was loyal to Steve and Pixar. So if you can't beat him, join him. We decided to look for ways we could join up with Pixar and have them make a film about toys for us." By this point, Jobs had poured close to $50 million of his own money into Pixar, more than half of what he had pocketed when he cashed out of Apple, and he was still losing money at Next. He was hard-nosed about it. He forced all Pixar employees to give up their options as part of his agreement to add another round of personal funding in 1991. But he was also a romantic in his love for what artistry and technology could do together. His belief that ordinary consumers would love to do 3D modeling on Pixar software turned out to be wrong, but that was soon replaced by an instinct that turned out to be right, that combining great art and digital technology would transform animated films more than anything since 1937, when Walt Disney had given life to Snow White. Looking back, Jobs said that had he known more, he would have focused on animation sooner and not worried about pushing the company's hardware or software applications. On the other hand, had he known the hardware and software would never be profitable, he would not have taken over Pixar. "Life kind of snookered me into doing that, and perhaps it was for the better." Chapter 20, A Regular Guy. Love is just a four-letter word. Joan Baez. In 1982, when he was still working on the Macintosh, Jobs met the famed folk singer Joan Baez through her sister Mimi Farina, who headed a charity that was trying to get donations of computers for prisons. A few weeks later, he and Baez had lunch in Cupertino. "I wasn't expecting a lot, but she was really smart and funny," he recalled. At the time, he was nearing the end of his relationship with Barbara Jasinski. They had vacationed in Hawaii, shared a house in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and even gone to one of Baez's concerts together. As his relationship with Jasinski flamed out, Jobs began getting more serious with Baez. He was 27 and Baez was 41, but for a few years they had a romance. It turned into a serious relationship between two accidental friends who became lovers, Jobs recalled in a somewhat wistful tone. Elizabeth Holmes, Jobs' friend from Reed College, believed that one of the reasons he went out with Baez, other than the fact that she was beautiful and funny and talented, was that she had once been the lover of Bob Dylan. Steve loved that connection to Dylan, she later said. Baez and Dylan had been lovers in the early 1960s, and they toured as friends after that, including with the Rolling Thunder Review in 1975. Jobs had the bootlegs of those concerts. When she met Jobs, Baez had a 14-year-old son, Gabriel, from her marriage to the anti-war activist David Harris. At lunch, she told Jobs she was trying to teach Gabe how to type. "You mean on a typewriter?" Jobs asked. When she said yes, he replied, "But a typewriter is antiquated." "If a typewriter is antiquated, what does that make me?" she asked. There was an awkward pause. As Baez later told me, "As soon as I said it, I realized the answer was so obvious. The question just hung in the air. I was just horrified." Much to the astonishment of the McIntosh team, Jobs burst into the office one day with Baez and showed her the prototype of the Macintosh. They were dumbfounded that he would reveal the computer to an outsider, given his obsession with secrecy, but they were even more blown away to be in the presence of Joan Baez. He gave Gabe an Apple II, and he later gave Baez a Macintosh. On visits, Jobs would show off the features he liked. He was sweet and patient, but he was so advanced in his knowledge that he had trouble teaching me, she recalled. He was a sudden multimillionaire. She was a world-famous celebrity, but sweetly down-to-earth and not all that wealthy. She didn't know what to make of him then, and still found him puzzling when she talked about him almost 30 years later. At one dinner early in their relationship, Jobs started talking about Ralph Lauren and his polo shop, which she admitted she had never visited. "There's a beautiful red dress there that would be perfect for you," he said, and then drove her to the store in the Stanford Mall. Baez recalled, "I said to myself, far out, terrific. I'm with one of the world's richest men, and he wants me to have this beautiful dress." When they got to the store, Jobs bought a handful of shirts for himself and showed her the red dress. "You ought to buy it," he said. She was a little surprised and told him she couldn't really afford it. He said nothing, and they left. "Wouldn't you think if someone had talked like that the whole evening that they were going to get it for you?" she asked me, seeming genuinely puzzled about the incident. "The mystery of the red dress is in your hands." I felt a bit strange about it. He would give her computers, but not a dress. And when he brought her flowers, he made sure to say they were left over from an event in the office. He was both romantic and afraid to be romantic, she said. When he was working on the next computer, he went to Baez's house in Woodside to show her how well it could produce music. He had it play a Brahms quartet, and he told me eventually computers would sound better than humans playing it, even get the innuendo and the cadences better, Baez recalled. She was revolted by the idea. He was working himself up into a fervor of delight, while I was shrinking into a rage and thinking, how could you defile music like that? Jobs would confide in Debbie Coleman and Joanna Hoffman about his relationship with Baez and worry about whether he could marry someone who had a teenage son and was probably past the point of wanting to have more children. At times he would belittle her as being an issues singer and not a true political singer like Dylan, said Hoffman. She was a strong woman, and he wanted to show he was in control. Plus, he always said he wanted to have a family, and with her, he knew that he wouldn't. And so, after about 3 years, they ended their romance and drifted into becoming just friends. "I thought I was in love with her, but I really just liked her a lot," he later said. "We weren't destined to be together. I wanted kids, and she didn't want any more." In her 1989 memoir, Baez wrote about her breakup with her husband and why she never remarried. "I belonged alone, which is how I have been since then, with occasional interruptions that are mostly picnics." She did add a nice acknowledgement at the end of the book to Steve Jobs for forcing me to use a word processor by putting one in my kitchen. Finding Joanne and Mona. When Jobs was 31, a year after his ouster from Apple, his mother, Clara, who was a smoker, was stricken with lung cancer. He spent time by her deathbed, talking to her in ways he had rarely done in the past, and asking some questions he had refrained from raising before. "When you and Dad got married, were you a virgin?" he asked. It was hard for her to talk, but she forced a smile. That's when she told him that she had been married before, to a man who never made it back from the war. She also filled in some of the details of how she and Paul Jobs had come to adopt him. Soon after that, Jobs succeeded in tracking down the woman who had put him up for adoption. His quiet quest to find her had begun in the early 1980s when he hired a detective who had failed to come up with anything. Then Jobs noticed the name of a San Francisco doctor on his birth certificate. "He was in the phone book, so I gave him a call," Jobs recalled. The doctor was no help. He claimed that his records had been destroyed in a fire. That was not true. In fact, right after Jobs called, the doctor wrote a letter, sealed it in an envelope, and wrote on it, "To be delivered to Steve Jobs on my death." When he died a short time later, his widow sent the letter to Jobs. In it, the doctor explained that his mother had been an unmarried graduate student from Wisconsin named Joanne Schabel. It took another few weeks and the work of another detective to track her down. After giving him up, Joanne had married his biological father, Abdul Fattah John Jandali, and they had another child, Mona. Jandali abandoned them 5 years later, and Joanne married a colorful ice skating instructor, George Simpson. That marriage didn't last long either, and in 1970 she began a meandering journey that took her and Mona, both of them now using the last name Simpson, to Los Angeles. Jobs had been reluctant to let Paul and Clara, whom he considered his real parents, know about his search for his birth mother. With a sensitivity that was unusual for him and which showed the deep affection he felt for his parents, he worried that they might be offended. So he never contacted Joanne Simpson until after Clara Jobs died in early 1986. "I never wanted them to feel like I didn't consider them my parents, because they were totally my parents," he recalled. "I loved them so much that I never wanted them to know of my search, and I even had reporters keep it quiet when any of them found out." When Clara died, he decided to tell Paul Jobs, who was perfectly comfortable, and said he didn't mind at all if Steve made contact with his biological mother. So one day Jobs called Joanne Simpson, said who he was, and arranged to come down to Los Angeles to meet her. He later claimed it was mainly out of curiosity. "I believe in environment more than heredity in determining your traits, but still you have to wonder a little about your biological roots," he said. He also wanted to reassure Joanne that what she had done was all right. "I wanted to meet my biological mother mostly to see if she was okay, and to thank her, because I'm glad I didn't end up as an abortion. She was 23, and she went through a lot to have me." Joanne was overcome with emotion when Jobs arrived at her Los Angeles house. She knew he was famous and rich, but she wasn't exactly sure why. She immediately began to pour out her emotions. She had been pressured to sign the papers putting him up for adoption, she said, and did so only when told that he was happy in the house of his new parents. She had always missed him and suffered about what she had done. She apologized over and over, even as Jobs kept reassuring her that he understood and that things had turned out just fine.